name's Sierra, and I'm an alcoholic. Nancy and I are nervous people. We must unite. Nervous people unite. And I was extraordinarily fond of speed. My best friend was a junkie. She scratched and picked, and I yapped and twitched. And we lived in New York City. We rode our kids up and down the streets of New York City with our little kids napping in the seat going like that. People would say, your kids are asleep, and we'd go, we're counting on it. And, you know, we had adventures. So I want to thank Zan and Harlan for, I don't know, my heart just is so full. I love Seaside, Oregon. This is the second time I've been here. I came up here for the She Thing, and it was amazing, and then I got invited back. How about that? And I got 86 from places because I was an unpleasant drunk and drug addict. I could be very charming, sort of seductive, and then all of a sudden people go, oops, get rid of her. And, you know, it's really interesting because I'm staggeringly self-absorbed. That hasn't changed a whole hell of a lot. And it's just what pleases me has changed enormously. And I want to thank Harlan and Zan. First of all, I think they're two of the most adorable critters on the planet. And I want to thank everybody that helps put this thing on. It has been such a delicious experience. You know, there is nothing like stopping doing what you shouldn't have done in the first place, i.e. drinking and using, to come face to face with yourself and then have all your character defects honored. Because one of my major character defects was, don't you know who I think I am? And I get to whip out the door with speaker on my chest going, I'm going to the head of the line. And it's like, don't you know who I think I am? Manifest in a way that's actually okay. Because the first time that one came up, my husband and I, he was still alive, and I had just inherited some money, like 20 cents about, from my dad, who had just corked off. And I wanted this dress at Saks Fifth Avenue. I don't know what, really, I think it was a dress, but I don't know who the hell. And I got on the phone with people because they wouldn't let me get it. And I went, don't you know who I am? I'm an heiress. And my husband goes, give me that phone. So you kind of get the picture. I'm a person who came from an endless line of alcoholism and drug addiction. I think my grandmother was a drug addict because she had extremely bad rheumatoid arthritis. And my father, in reaction to her, decided no drugs at all, whatever, just alcohol. And he was one of those people who snapped. First drink, all bets were off. One, he would either cry and mope, which was totally disgusting, or he would get meaner than a snake and say really shitty things about all your favorite people. And when I was 11, I turned on him. And my stepmother at the time said, I have never seen anyone turn so fast as you did. And that, I carried that into adulthood. But that the meaner than a snake thing has been very interesting to watch, the manifestation of alcoholism. Let me finish telling you about my dad. So he didn't believe in drugs. So he did things like get wisdom teeth pulled without anesthetic. And I knew that there was a better way to go, hence my extraordinary fondness. So, but I was also never going to be like him. And the thing I've come to realize is that I am extremely good at wrapping the package differently. and trotting out the same old stuff. Because I was just as mean as my dad in a completely different way. I was just as cold as my stepmother, who was an, you know, I used to call her the walk-in refrigerator. And just as free-living and loving as my mother, who died when I was six, from all reports. I remember as a kid, and she was really, really fun. But adults, I've run into adults that knew her who said she was really, really fun. And so alcoholism runs rampant in my family. My grandfather had a still in the backwoods of South Carolina. We had this old car so you wouldn't get high-centered on the roads. And this guy ran the still, and he had a bunch of coon hounds that protected it, which we knew. Ha-ha. It's like an important person. An important person has always been one of my prevailing factors. I drank and used for 25 years. I thought I was extraordinarily sophisticated. I saw a picture of my mother and father on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. They both had cigarettes. They were walking in, she had a hat, coat, heels, dress. My dad was in whatever men wear, not short pants. And they were walking down the Champs-Élysées, and that's my perception of my drinking and using. When I really recall my drinking and using, it would be things like I would be sitting on the curb in New York City in my New Year's Eve dress and my matching shoes, taking a little rest because I'd walked out of the party because I was pissed at my boyfriend. And the cops would come by and go, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, I'm just taking a little rest." And they go, "Oh, okay." You know, the thing that amazes me is that I got along for a really, really long time based on the rules don't apply to me. And that still runs in me today, only I know when to use it most of the time. I'm an artist, and I know I can try and break the rules and break the rules and break the rules. I work in clay, so for the most part, I can break the rules. But every once in a while, it goes, watch this. And the whole thing falls apart. And then what I learned to do is how to put it back together again. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me humanity. It has, my belief in a higher power is swirling atoms. I believe in that which connects us all. I read a book one time called My Stroke of Insight by a woman who's a neurophysicist. Her name was Jill Taylor Bolt, and she watched herself have a brain bleed and then caught it in enough time so that she began her recovery, which took her 8 years. But one of the things she said in the book, which had been profoundly important to me, is that 99.99% of us are all the same. All the anomalies that happen in us is in that 0.01%, which I don't know why, but that's extraordinarily comforting to me. Because one of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is that the ability to be among. Because I had to be important. I remember when I first, I wasn't first sober. I wasn't even remotely close to being sober, that's for damn sure. But at any rate, I was watching Johnny Carson, and this fabulous actress was on with him. And he said, this is about the time when Bob Altman's Nashville came out. And he said, you're doing extremely well these days. She said, "Oh, yeah, you know. Not only must I succeed, but my friends must fail." Now, she was joking. She was joking. I went, "Yeah." It didn't occur to me that that wasn't the way it was. It didn't occur to me that this was a profoundly abundant world and that I was profoundly lucky to be in the world, in this country, in this place, amongst these people, and ultimately amongst you. I believe that I am sober because I was lucky. There was a confluence of things that happened. I was in a play, and I started as an artist, became an actress, you know, rocket to stardom, get something for nothing. And I was in a play and they were cutting my lines because the play was basically about Asians. I was one of two Caucasians in the play, and I was like really upset because they were cutting my lines. And so unbeknownst to me, my brother was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I called him up and because I was downtown in LA and he lived in Glendale. And I said, Chewy. His name was Churchill, but I couldn't say it when I was a teeny tot. So he was Chewy for life. And I said, Chewy, they're cutting my lines. And he goes, oh, come over here for crying out loud. And I said, I'm in creative crisis. It's just terrible. Just terrible. And he goes, well, I think you should go to therapy. And I go, Chewy, he had no idea I was a drunk and a drug addict. No idea, because I lived in L.A. He lived in Glendale. That's like 30 miles apart, but we weren't speaking. Because he was furious with me. Furious. I had been living in New York. I was supposed to cover that quarter of the U.S. My stepbrother, Collie, had D.C. My stepbrother, Ken, had the Stanford area, and Chewy had Southern California, and there I was. I had broken all the rules that I didn't know existed. So he was a little bit pissed at me, and I said, I'm in creative crisis. He said, well, you need to go to my therapist. And I said, but Chewy, I don't want to be an insurance underwriter. That was his job. He said, oh, you jackass. Listen, you go to therapy to become who you are, not who I am. It's just I know her, so I can introduce you. So I go, okay, because I was in creative crisis. It was really serious, creative crisis. You know, anyway, whatever. So I get in this group, and unbeknownst to me, it's a group of women. Every single one of them is sober. The minimum amount of years was 4, up to 16 and 20. So I'm in group, and I'm angry. So, you know, angry baby, angry mom, angry dad, angry brother, angry sister, angry boyfriend, anyone angry, I'll volunteer to be angry for you because I am extremely proud of my anger. Only I don't say that. It's just I'm not afraid of my anger is what I say. And so, you know, these people watched me for about 6 months. And then at one point, I auditioned for something called The Right Stuff. And it was a movie, and it was mine. It was mine. There was no two ways about it. And somebody else got it. And so I was a real horse's ass that night. And I got home, and my brother Chewy had called, so I called him back. Then I went into a blackout. And then I went, oh, shoot, Chewy called, and I called him back. And I went back into a blackout. And I went, oh, shoot, Chewy called. Went and called him, went into a blackout. Did that 4 times. And so the next morning I get up and I go, oh, Chewy called. So I get on the phone and I go, Chewy, he goes, you were in a blackout. What are you going to do about it? And I go, I was not in a blackout. And my son was leaning against the wall like this. And he goes, yeah, you were, Mom. I heard all the phone calls. I go, if there's anything I hate, and I still hate it to this day, is getting caught. I just hate getting caught. However, I did know what to do because I had a roommate at the time. And we were writing projects together. Well, that's kind of an oxymoron. But at any rate, we were, in theory, writing projects together. And she had gotten sober, and she was my lower companion. I stole her drugs. At any rate, she didn't notice. And so I didn't believe. I bought liquor, stole drugs. It was principle. I stole drugs. Only speed, but stole it. It was really fun. I loved cleaning out people's cupboards. What happened to all those pills? I don't know. I'm really good. And so she got sober doing coke. I didn't know that wasn't how you did it, but her not drinking was a hell of a big improvement. And so So she had taken me to, a couple of places where she got cakes and stuff for being sober. And so I knew where to go. But that Saturday morning was, the session with my fellow therapy people. So I go into the thing and I go, "Barbara, I'm an alcoholic." She said, "Oh, that's nice, dear. Would you like to tell the group?" And I go, "Nah, it's personal. I'm going to tell them one at a time." And she goes, "Group, Sierra's got something to tell you." And so I go, "I'm an alcoholic." And they all go, "Duh." They had been watching me for however long we'd been going through this angry person exchange, and then my commitment to suffering. Because I suffered well, you know. If you saw that tear trickle down my cheek, you would give me whatever I wanted, and I, you know, whatever. So they cradled me into Alcoholics Anonymous. They would tell me where to go, who to hear, and there was this woman standing behind me, and I found out you have to have a sponsor. So I turned around. Dusty was standing behind me. I said, "Will you be my sponsor?" She goes, "Yeah, until I find you another one, because you're a pain in the ass." I'm really well brought up. I am not a pain in the ass. I'm charming. I don't think charming has ever really been applied to me, but, you know, in my fantasy, yeah, it was. And so they cradled me everywhere I needed to go. And the first one said, "You have to hear Sam Hardy sing the Lord's Prayer." I go, "I hate the Lord's Prayer." They go, "Well, we don't give a shit. You need to hear Sam sing it. He's from Alabama, and it's like hounds baying at the moon. It will entertain the hell out of you." And I go, "Okay." So this place was on Beverly Boulevard in Beverly Hills. And so I go down there, and sure enough, there's Sam. And it does sound like hounds baying at the moon. I was like, "This is impressive." I still don't like it, but it's impressive. And so they just made sure I got to meetings. And so I started volunteering to be of service. Anyway, I'm an eye roller, by the way, and I'm slowly recovering from eye rolling. It's a really unattractive trait, and I usually am sitting in the front row facing the person I'm rolling my eyes about when it happens. So I've had to learn not to do it. And one of the ways I do it is I'm leaving my glasses on, because I take my glasses off and then I scrub my eyes, and that stops me from eye rolling, but it also sends my makeup down my cheeks and I look like a raccoon. And so so I go to this meeting at Camden, and this woman gets up and she says, "My name is Jeannie Johnson Theodore, and I'm a very, very, very grateful alcoholic. How many of you have tried to commit suicide? Once, twice, three times? You're in the right place. I was standing on a balcony naked in Madrid, Spain, and I was ready to jump off, and I had the best job I'd ever had in my life. And as I went to jump, I got thrown to the back of the room, and there was a handprint on my thigh, and I was alone." I think I really like this woman. So then she's like this tall, with bazooms for days. And she has terry slip-ons on her feet because she has peripheral nephritis. She has on a leopard coat. She has Veronica Lake hair that comes down to here kind of over one eye. Tattooed eye makeup. Joan Crawford lips. Gold nails out to here with a J tie tack stuck in one of them. She looked like drag queens I'd known in New York, and she felt like home to me. But I wouldn't ask her to sponsor me because, well, I didn't know you could, and I had Dusty, who thought I was tacky, but that's all right. And so afterwards they say, help clean up, please. And I go. So first of all, I won't let anyone touch me. No hugging, no nothing. This lurching at you like Baby Huey was really horrible. And so I hook pinkies and say, or don't say, whatever prayer comes up. And then I volunteer to clean up. And I pick up my trash, put it in the can, and leave. I've cleaned up. As you may have gathered, generosity was not my strong suit. The willingness to work with others was not my strong suit. The ability to, my neediness was paramount. It was and at that time, I didn't know that there was a huge difference between being special and effective. And my need for attention was overwhelming, and at the same time, my need to be invisible was balanced it out. And, you know, my first job in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was working for a doctor's office. What was really fascinating to me was, first of all, one of the speeds I really loved was Ritalin. They seemed to be just sort of hanging out of the drawers, you know, all the samples that they had, you know, that they give doctors, like speed, hanging out drawers, you know, all this stuff was hanging, and I didn't want it. One of the things that really has come to be impressive to me over time was once I made the decision that I wasn't going to drink and use anymore, once I had been brought to the place where I found myself lying in the middle of the floor, curled in a fetal position, going, this is as good as it gets. I had probably poisoned myself a couple of years before with drugs and alcohol, but I had the emotional fallout that ended up happening became extraordinarily profound. And one of the people that I talk to all the time says she believes this is a disease of self-hatred manifesting by profound self-destruction. And I believe that's accurate. And one of the reasons I am really glad I have never had to go out is that my ego is such that the self-hatred that would engender would be so severe that I would not be able to make it back. And I don't think I'm one of those people that would kill myself. Nor do I think I'm one of those people that would be killed by my usage. I think I would be down and out and know it. And I can't think of a hell worse than that, quite frankly. This year has been an extraordinary year for me. You guys, the she thing people heard the beginning of it. I moved a friend into my house with me who's also sober. She's my best friend. She has, you know, the results of this disease. She has no money and no medical insurance. And she has serious Hep C, heavy metals, and various other ancillary effects that happen as a result of this disease. But she's also brilliant at creating websites and PR packets and stuff like that and putting houses together, which I am not. My house, I thought, was really, really well decorated. I'm an artist, and, you know, everything was up for vision. It looked like a storage shed is what, you know, where I was living. And she was able to turn it into a house that people said, wow, this place is really cool. No one was going, people would say, this could be a really cool place. No one was saying this is really cool under my direction. And so one of the things, and I had been working on impatience, and one of the things she said, I promise you, however long this is going to take, I am going to try your patience to the max. And that's true. And what's happened is one of the things I realized when I came in, I was profoundly and seriously enraged when I got here. And that that is, you know, the cover up for me in that case was grief, serious, serious grief. 8 years before I had gotten sober, my husband had been murdered, and I was there, and he killed the guy that killed him. So there were two dead guys in the apartment, and I had no way to know how to grieve from that, none at all. And I dealt in competitive tragedy. You know, you tell me something that's fairly serious, and I'll slap out a dead guy and beat you hands down. And so this went on into sobriety for at least eight years at 60, but 4 or 5 years in, I met Earl. No, I didn't meet Earl H. Earl H was in this, you know, the Try God group with me. Try God, person who cannot say the word, at any rate. And Earl says, I think I can really support you in this. I said, in what? This dead people thing. And I go, that's not his words, but it's my words. And so I go, oh, really? And then he tells me the story about his family flying over the jungle, and there's a hit out on his dad, and the plane goes down, and he's lying there with a broken back, and the entire family is dying around him. And I'm going, God damn it. He... he trumped my tragedy. Now, you think I might be able to learn something from that. No. I just learned how to be very careful how I told about my tragedy. It's like that friend of mine before I got sober, the one that got sober doing coke. By the way, she's the one that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous unwittingly. She also never made it. And one of the things is, you know, it is an awe, because she was a fabulous human being. However, I really, truly believe I'm sober because I'm lucky. I was not chosen. I was not picked out over somebody else. Somebody didn't get it because I got it. No, I was lucky. Something in the primordial ooze of my brain, without my awareness, knew I needed to grab that seat and hang on and hang on and hang on till I became conscious. Because I was not conscious at that time. But Sylvie said to me, you always say no. And I said, no, I don't. Now, I told you, I don't like to get caught, but I do like to get caught when it's a good story. And that's a good story. So, woohoo, no, I don't. But you think I might learn yes might be the alternative to no? No. What it was... be quiet while your brain is screaming no and see if you can come up with another answer. Sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. And then sometimes I have to stay quiet for an inordinately long time because working through that no is very hard. And this year, I started as an actress. When I was in sobriety, I was already an actress. And I was an actor when my husband was killed. And he was an actor and a director. And, you know, we were a pair. And only I was the star. Such a little shit. At any rate, I got a couple of plays that he wanted. You know, the kind of the casting, male-female, was left up for grabs, but they realized that if they put in a woman, it could be really meaner than if it was a guy. If it was a guy, you'd be like using a hammer. And if it was a woman, it could be a little more subtle. A little more. But at any rate, I finally said to him, you get to audition uptown. I get to audition downtown. I get to go uptown if I'm invited to audition. You get to come downtown if I invite you. And he goes, something doesn't seem right about that equation. I go, well, that's the way it is. And so the thing about acting was when I started acting, it was one of those times when everything was starting up. Off-Broadway was starting up. So you got invited to do everything. It seemed really easy, and it was an adjunct to being an artist. When I moved to California after my husband was murdered, I thought I had a ticket to ride. It had been in all the papers. I thought people were going to give me what I wanted. You know, large sums of money were going to fly out of the sky, and I was going to get prizes because I was born, not because I earned it, because you saw that tiny tear trickle down my cheek and then gave me what I wanted. And it did work for a while, actually, because I got all the angry parts, and angry parts are really, you know, a lot of people are afraid of their anger. I was not. When I got sober, this was 8 years after my husband's death, about 5 years into my sobriety, the anger started to break up. And then the soggy, messy part of me started to show. And that was not as useful. And so I started not getting what I wanted. And the interesting thing about not getting what you want is it almost always pays off well, but if you're a tantrum thrower, which I was, it doesn't seem right. And so I auditioned for this series with a guy named Ralph W., and I auditioned and auditioned and auditioned and auditioned and auditioned for it. And I came in second. And I finally met the woman that got it years later. And she said to me, "That was the hardest shoot I've ever been on. The entire crew was drunk and loaded all the time, with exception of Ralph, who was the director and creator, and me and one other person." And what I realized was I had been protected from myself, because I was 6 months sober at the time. And there is no way I could have survived that given the character defects that I had at work in my life. You know, rocket to stardom, don't you know who I think I am? You know, I'm a star, you're not. And all that kind of stuff, not to mention rude, irritable, and discontent. And so I began to see that things do actually work out. And I began to get enough sobriety to be tested in situations. But always, I have been protected mostly by my own personal incompetence, but sometimes by just circumstance, from having to make the mistakes I could very likely have made. And this last year has been absolutely extraordinary. I am beginning to understand the value of time. You know, I hear people say, everybody's only got one day. The truth is, we only get to live in one day. But most of the time, we have more than one day. Sometimes we don't, but most of the time we do. And we have had more than one day that gets us to where we are in each successive moment. And as I said, I was working on impatience. And, you know, as my rage left, the grief began to break up. Then it became profound sadness. And then it became, you know, whatever wasn't working out for me. But up until I was 16 years sober, I never grieved my husband's death. Never. And really fabulous person trapped me. She had me tell the story in a mixed group, and it was a business group, and she said, "Just tell the story." And she watched how I behaved when people responded to what I told them about his death. And then she said, "Now we're going to have a women's group, and you're going to be in the women's group, and you're going to tell the same story again, and then you're going to shut up. And you have to hear absolutely everything these women have to say to you." And they responded with the feelings that a healing, grieving person feels. And I realized after I heard that I had never dealt with that. And she said, "No, you haven't, and here's the person you're going to go talk to." And I talked to her for 4 years, and a lot of stuff got sorted out. And a lot of stuff got, you know, I hang on to stuff that I can use against you, and a lot of that stuff had to break up. My competitive tragedy had to go. And the unwillingness to give to others what they so needed when I was unable to take it in myself. It's a really stingy place to live. So what has happened this year is I have been taking care of this friend of mine, and she has been taking care of me, truth be told, though she is aggravating as all hell. She's got ADD, and I don't know what the hell else, but, you know, it's annoying. And I don't do annoyed well or inconvenienced well. I'm just a shitty little person behaving shittily when I don't get what I want. It's not attractive. And so what happened was for that whole year I was working on impatience, and all of a sudden my landlords show up and say, we want you out. We don't like her. We don't like the way you fixed up the house. We don't like the feng shui crap in the back. And we don't want you. And I go, you know, but they made the mistake of saying, we don't want you, to my friend. And one of the things I have running in spades is, it's not fair. And when something isn't fair, I ride in high dudgeon, screeching. And, which isn't great, but at any rate, it's not even effective, quite frankly. But when my husband died, my life jumped the tracks, and I spent a lot of time trying to get the tracks to come back together again. It was just, I was living another life running parallel. When I got kicked out of this house, I haven't left it yet, by the way. We're in a situation. But at any rate, when I got kicked out of the house, my life jumped the tracks again. And now I had parallel tracks. It means something else is going to happen. But having to let go of my security blanket was more than I could bear. And my impatience ramped so seriously what I really had to start taking a look at myself. And this woman had said to me when I was 2 years sober, she's a psychiatrist and she's sober, and she said, Sierra, this is how you learn to do that. I asked how I became abusive, and whatever I was sharing was how I did it. She said, you were 2 years old, that's how you learned to do it. My dad used to trip me over and over and over again, and I'd come up fighting. And she said, that's how you learned to do it. You've wrapped it differently, but that's how you learn to do it. We do become what we hate. She said, here's the good thing, though. You learned it. Therefore, you can unlearn it. However, what you need to do is get very, very, very specific about each thing you're unraveling. Otherwise, the overarching fear, sadness, alarm, whatever, is too big to sort out, and you never get out of the morass that is created by that. And I said, I don't understand. I was talking to this friend of mine, this inordinate need to take care of people. By the way, I didn't mention, did I? That I came in through Al-Anon? Ow. 32 years in Al-Anon. I like to blame people. And then I found adult children, and, you know, that was specific blaming. And then this really rude person named Sonia, who is a dental technician, came up to me, and she was a double winner, and she goes, honey, I sent this sort of fume of pot. You're twitching, so I suspect speed. And this non-detectable vodka is all over the place. You are your problem. No one else is. It took me a couple of months after that to get sober, but still, you know, I was in group. So, there you go. And anyway, so now, 31 years later, I go, where did this need to take care of people come from? When I was 6, my mother died, and my grandmother called me in to tell me, me and my brother, that he was 4 and I was 6, and she said, Mimi died, and I said, I need to write a letter to Pete. That was my father. He was in the South Pacific in World War II. He needs to know that his wife and my mom is dead. And she said, I'll help you write the letter. Now there, self-created, was my need to take care of people. 2 days later, I get sent out with Chewy, and where we're staying is this huge place, and there's a big weeping beech tree that walks down to the ground, and I, at 6, can walk up into it. It didn't occur to me that Chewy at 4 might have a hard time. So I walk him up this tree limb, and he falls off and cuts his eye, and they go, Sierra's trying to kill her brother. The resentment started there. I was helping my brother. I was playing with my brother. I was showing him an adventure, and people didn't understand me. I was misunderstood. Tragic. So, not only will I take care of you, but I will hate you for it. So that is really, you know, you take, you know, you ramp that out there long enough, and it builds to some unattractive heights. And so in this last year, 3 weeks ago, I found this out. You don't think my life hasn't been transformed? I have one sponsee that I scream at, or I used to. This is just short-lived. But at any rate, I scream at her, and a friend of mine said to me, you know, if you scream at her, that's probably family of origin stuff. She is probably used to being screamed at. I would suggest trying not screaming. And I was able to hear that as a suggestion, and I went, good, that's a good idea, I'll give it a shot. The next day it came up, every single annoying thing she does came up, and I was able to handle it differently and way more effectively. And I went, oh, very interesting. How well do I listen to people screaming at me, unless they're yelling stop, because I'm, you know, in a life-threatening situation? And the thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is the ability to include others, the ability to catch myself when I am extremely rude. You know, I was horrible to a woman at 3 a.m. at Ralph's supermarket, and the checker, actually, and it was a icky kick the dog situation. And at 6 a.m., I had to go back to the supermarket, and sure enough, I got Sue again. And so I said, Sue, I really owe you an amends for being really a creep. And she said, yeah, you were a creep. She said, but I have to thank you for this, because we get this day in and day out, and no one ever acknowledges what they've done. And, you know, then, of course, I think she's going to be my new best friend, but no, not at all. However, what it is that I now can catch myself. And, that saying, I am responsible, is really, really important to me. Because if I am responsible for my life, you're not. And if you're not responsible for my life, I don't resent you. And my resentment quotient is based on my inability to take responsibility for my own life. I came in thinking I had no resentments at all. And about 10 seconds into sobriety, I found out I had nothing but resentments. I believe in transforming my character defects, not getting rid of them. I want every bit of energy that's in there for me. But if I, you know, if rocket to stardom is my thing, then how do I build that and build slowly? How do I help you build effectively? How do I support you in your creativity and your sobriety? My creativity is a gift. I cannot take it for granted. I have to honor it, value it, and work it. Work being the operative word. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to work. It's been given me the ability to be among you. It's given me the ability to laugh at my, you know, asininity, which is legion. And it's opened my heart sufficiently to love. I believed, you know, there was a time when I believed in, you know, tolerance rather than love. I believe in tolerance. I think tolerance is really important. My anger was tolerated. But I also find that my heart is open enough so I'm able to love people. I don't necessarily know what that's supposed to feel like. I just know that I'm really thrilled to see you. And that has to be enough for now, because the other is infatuation, and I was addicted to infatuation. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the breadth of recovery to include that which I don't like. Because we were talking this morning at breakfast, and I said, you know, a lot of the people I hated the most end up being my best friends. And so, you know, I've had to sort of get over myself or just sort of watch. I'm going to hate you until I don't. Let's see how that goes. And, you know, now I know that's funny. But when I was being a little shit, it wasn't so funny because I was nasty and ignoring and pushing you aside. And listening to all these speakers today, I mean, this weekend, that just so moved my heart. It's the first time I've heard those kind of speakers. It's just amazing. It's amazing to me. Alcoholics Anonymous is a gift. I am so grateful I'm not drunk. And I really love being sober because it has given me my life, and it's given me you, and it's given me possibility. So thank you. Four 11.